Okay, I call the Audit, Compliance, and Title IX Committee to order. Could I have roll call, please?
Chair Carter.
Present.
Vice Chair Del Carlo.
Here.
Regent Arriscada.
Here.
Regent Dubrava.
Here.
Regent Geddes.
Here.
You do have a quorum.
Thank you. We'll start with public comment in Las Vegas, which I don't think we have any. Do we have any public comment in Reno? I don't think so. Do we have any public comment in Elko?
No public comment in Elko.
Very good. So we'll move on to item number two, consent items. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Move to approve.
Is there a motion and a second? Any discussion? Hearing none and seeing none. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, that motion carries. We'll move on to item number three, chair's report. We do have another development thing today. Last year around this time, we had one from our external auditor. I found it great, so we've invited them back again to kind of tell us about some of the trends in higher education. And that's all for my chair's report. So we'll go to number four, item number four, revenue controls, TMCC, Chief Internal Auditor Joe Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury, Chief Internal Auditor. In the audit summary document, I've included a table of reports being presented today, which includes updates on the follow-up audit that was just approved a few moments ago. As always, I want to say thank you to the institutions and the offices with reports being presented today. The first audit report today is revenue controls for TMCC. So often in our audits, the committee sees that we have a focus, understandably, on expenditures, right? Where is that money going? Is it being spent appropriately, et cetera? That's perfectly in line with our normal testing, and it's part of most standard audits. But it's important that we take a look at the other side of the equation, take a look at controls surrounding revenues of a given institution, thinking about how it's collected, recorded, deposited appropriately in line with policy and best practice. I think the audit team in Reno put together an excellent report with a few observations, recommendations, and responses related to deposit processes, reviews of sales activity, reconciliations, items along those lines that will strengthen the control environment around cash-related items. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Do we have a motion to accept the report?
So moved.
So the motion, do we have a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Hearing none and seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, motion passes. We'll go on to item number five. Just as a really, really brief introduction, so we have that compliance helpline, and this is one item that kind of got on our radar from that helpline without getting into too many specifics, but that led to digging a little bit more, and that flexibility that we changed in the audit committee and in the audit department to allow some flexibility helped to get this little project completed. Chief Internal Auditor, Justin Berry.
Thank you, Chair Carter. Joe Sunbury, for the record, I think you teed this one up perfectly. I'm hoping, and I can't see her, but we do have the Director of Retirement Administration available in the Las Vegas boardroom, I hope, if there are any specific questions on this item. But as I continue to tee this one up, wanted to point out that this audit relates to the required defined contribution retirement plan alternative that's a condition of employment with ENSHI. So we're talking about that component, not the public employees retirement system, or PERS, that we all know. So as seen in the report and some of those graphs, those plan assets related to this plan have nearly doubled in the last 6 years. And as of last year, had approximately $4.3 billion, that's billion with a B, in combined assets with over 16,000 participants. So for this review, our focus was really compliance with retirement plan docs, reviewing the distribution processes and those related controls. And some of our suggestions for improvements are in the areas of termination processes and those specific approvals, reviews of distribution reports, as well as some staffing and training recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have a motion to accept that report?
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none and seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Do we have any opposed? Motion passes. We move on to item number 6, Internal Audit Department Work Plan and Status. Chief Internal Auditor Joe Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury. I appreciate the committee's continued indulgence on this item. So about 2 years ago, I referenced the idea of moving away from, and you alluded to it a few moments ago, Regent Carter, Chair Carter, moving away from our standard work plan, which was sort of a one-year static plan, didn't give us a whole lot of flexibility, and started moving toward a semi-annual plan, one that is not only in line with best practices from audit shops around the country, but it's a way for us to be a little bit more agile, a little bit more flexible in how we can perform our work. And I've stated this at previous meetings before, but I think this is good for a few reasons. Want to give this committee as much of a real-time snapshot of what we're planning to work on, what we are working on currently, and the monitoring of items that we've already worked on. And that's how this document kind of follows that same logic, right? So I'll just quickly point out a few items, point the committee to pages 3 and 4, which speak to the approach of how this plan is put together, the measures taken to ensure it builds in that agility and flexibility, so that as important but unforeseen projects come up throughout the year, we have that flexibility to provide resources in a timely fashion. That approach continues to come in handy to this day. So it also speaks to some of the highlights and themes, and I'm not going to read those verbatim, but I always like to touch on the training aspect to show the committee the commitment from the audit team in terms of continuing education, staying current with our certifications. And again, the continued theme for my team is relevance. And to stay relevant, internal, external training must be included and, quite honestly, expected. In addition, wanted to draw attention to the hours related to non-traditional work. So that advisory and consulting type of work seems to be where we can add a lot of value and ideally save a lot of costs. And when we first dabbled in this with this approach, it was really just more of a sliver of the overall audit program. But as you look at our overall hours now, it's nearly a 60-40 split. It's about a third of our overall plan and hours that you see. So I'm happy to speak to any specific terms in terms of themes, and those are always going to be at the core of what we're trying to do. But I do want to point out to this committee, you know, we utilize a lot of feedback from our key stakeholders and really take that input in order to focus on where we can add value and address risks. Again, this committee's probably heard me talk about each of these themes before, and I'm not going to repeat them today, but I genuinely believe in the last item on page 4, and that is, you know, there's a strong correlation in the value that internal audit can bring to an organization and how often internal audit's phone rings. And I know it sounds like a silly measurement, and it's kind of, I call it an unofficial metric, but it's something that I think we've embraced as a team, and it ties into all of this. You know, we can't successfully perform our work or add our maximum value without that engagement and that buy-in from all the folks in this room and specifically from the institution. So I continue to be grateful for those important relationships and inputs, because I think it leads to better work in the end. So please keep calling. And I'll pause there before I move on to the next part of the report.
Are there any questions for Mr. Sunbury? Hearing none, you can continue.
Thank you. And for those of you who've been on the committee for a few years, page 7 is where you'll see some charts and graphs that are tracking our open findings at the institutions. And again, I love to remind the committee that this report was pushing 200 pages as of a few years ago. And so based on loud and clear feedback and some formatting efforts, removal of some duplicative items, we've got this thing under 40 pages and much more digestible. So a few highlights and discussions. So on page 7, this is the graph that tracks unresolved audit findings, which shows the 5-year trends. And you'll see that a few years ago, these unresolved items were in the 30s.
and that in more recent periods that number has been shaved down to single digits in terms of unresolved findings. So looking at that overall trend, it's a good trajectory, and it's really the combined effort, right? It's the enhanced tracking by this committee, and it's also the hard work and buy-in from the institutions, right? And while this graph goes back 5 years, if you go back 10 years, this number was consistently in the 60s and 70s. So we've really come a long way with the help of this committee. And I think it's one of the more useful metrics that we have in internal audit is number of open issues or number of past due issues. Because beyond just the general accountability, it's really an indicator that are we getting management's buy-in and are we making recommendations that make sense. So I will pause there.
Are there any questions or discussion for Mr. Sunbury?
Chair Carter?
Yes.
Thank you. I just want to say to you, Chief Auditor Sunbury, this is really commendable. So, I mean, I think it's really, when you get down to single digits from the 30s, this is great and well done.
Thank you, and I will pass that along to the folks that are doing the actual work, not me, right? But, no. And that is actually the conclusion of my remarks for this item, Chair Carter. If you have any other questions or comments,
sure. Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion. Do we have a second? There's a motion and a second. Any other discussion? I will say I do love slide 7. I know when I inherited the committee, it was pretty high. And now it's getting pretty low or trending low, so hopefully that trend can continue next year when I'm off the board. Any other discussion or questions? Well, I will say, I believe it's the 15th, Mr. Sunbury and some of the other auditors, or at least one, is presenting at a conference talking about the audit department. So a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Item 6 passes. We'll move on to item number 7, internal audit compliance and Title IX updates. Mr. Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury. So we introduced this section as a standing item to provide departmental updates, one of which Chair Carter kindly just gave. And more importantly, just have a discussion around risk and compliance. And in the past, we've talked about financial aid-related findings. We've walked through updated risk assessment methodologies. Really just spoke about just work we were doing related to other board initiatives. My updates, as I see our guest speaker arrive online here, are going to be very, very brief in this section. One, at our December meeting is when we'll have our comprehensive updates and metrics to related to the compliance hotline and incident management system. The spoiler that I will give related to that is we have seen an increase in volume of that activity. But that's consistent with what we've seen in past years when folks do get onto the campus in that fall semester, and as we've kind of climbed out of this pandemic and more people are there in person. Also at December, I hope to have a guest speaker related to a deeper dive into compliance areas and progress we've made on that front with the influence of this committee. And again, as speaking of guest speakers, next week my audit manager Lauren Tripp and I will be rocking out at the ACUA conference in Las Vegas. That is the Association of College and University Auditors. For those of you that may not be familiar, as a reminder, Lauren served in an interim capacity for a good 5 to 6 months this year. At Nevada State College, and we just want to share that success story. And I think it was a group effort, right, with her, the institution, the support of this committee. And so I think it'll be a good presentation. I'd be happy to send a copy of it when it's all said and done to the committee or to the board as a whole. And speaking of presentations, we have a treat for the committee and everyone in attendance today. And it is the next agenda item, but I just wanted to say now that I'm very appreciative of Grant Thornton, specifically Matt Unterman, who will be leading this presentation and workshop today that I hope you'll find useful and constructive. And I will yield any extra time I have to that presentation because I think it'll be well worth it. So thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Sunbury? Real quick, I'm sorry. Are there any questions for Mr. Sunbury? Hearing and seeing none, then we'll move on to item number 8. This is the development session. Our external auditor is gracious in providing us a couple trainings or even a few trainings a year. We had him last year and had a great presentation, so the bar is set high. So you can take over, Mr. Utterman.
Thank you very much. For the record, Matt Unterman with Grant Thornton. Just confirming, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
We can hear you in Vegas, yeah.
Great, wonderful. And I have some slides, if someone could pull them up on screen. As those are coming up, I just want to thank you to the Regents, to Chair Carter, to Joe Sunbury for the opportunity to present to you today. It really was a wonderful opportunity to speak with you a year ago about the state of higher education in 2021. Today, we'll be speaking the state of higher education in 2022. Just confirming, looks like we have some slides on screen here. Okay. Are those, just apologize, Chair Carter, those appearing for people large?
So I'll say just for Vegas, I can see them here. All the regents would have them in their board pack. But if somebody from Elko can clarify there as well.
We can see it.
Fine. Okay. Yeah, they were small for me, but I have a printout myself too. So as long as you all can see them, then that's great. So good. Well, next slide. There we are. There's my picture. So something is different in this slide. Back one slide, please. That was my joke. You know, something may be different in the prior slide. It must be the glasses was my joke. Some things have changed over the pandemic. Last year, you may recall, I'm the guy who's fairly excited about higher education. And I apologized at the beginning from the start saying, I apologize for my excitement. I hope it's taken with respect for this meeting. And I'm very excited about where we are in terms of higher education. Last year, I'm the guy who did 72 slides in 45 minutes. I thought, we did that just fine last year. So we're doing 76 today, which clearly we're not going to do all 76 in great detail, but I know you all have these in your pre-read packets and hopefully went through them. To the extent you do have questions, I'm happy to go through them. I'm planning just at a kind of a blazing pace to go through what we're seeing, covering some things, and certainly going to have some Q&A at the end. Last year, we talked about a series of topics. We talked about creating a sustainable future, harnessing technology for growth, and supporting the campus community. We discussed a series of articles that we'd written and thought pieces in these three buckets. I would say 2021 was certainly an exciting time for higher education, a bit of a scary time, given that we were certainly still in the height of the pandemic. At this point, we certainly have more clarity about the future and what's been happening this year. Looking forward to discussing with that you today. Next slide, please. The agenda for today's presentation is largely based on our recent white paper, the State of the Industry publication on the right. If any of you would like a copy, feel free, or the link is included on the right. We are going to start with a few opening remarks, just in terms of what's been happening in general, so we don't lose the forest for the trees. We will cover some notable items from 2021. They were at the cutting edge in 2021. Frankly, they're still relevant now. I wanted just to highlight some things because I think it really sets the stage for where we are in 2022. And then we'll go through three areas in 2022, creating an equitable and sustainable future / growth, navigating what we're calling the great reshuffle and the great resignation or some workforce challenges, strengthening the campus, and we'll wrap up with the road ahead. Again, we're gonna cover a lot of ground here, starting with some opening remarks. Next slide, please. And next slide, please, slide 6. So higher education is truly entering into a new phase. We have 1 million fewer students enrolled in college now than before the pandemic began. We have high school graduates continue to decline. Certain areas of the U.S. are going to be particularly hit by the enrollment cliff, less so the West than the East. But, you know, we are seeing a series of decline amongst the nation's private institutions. The public have been less hit than during the pandemic. We see variations in 4-year versus 2-year, et cetera. The point is the pandemic has really shaken things up and there's more shakeup to come, particularly from an enrollment cliff perspective. But that's the COVID and enrollment isn't the only trend that's really happened and shown itself during the pandemic. In a lot of ways, the pandemic accelerated and exacerbated a series of trends that were happening for some time. For example, the utilization of technology for the provision of pedagogical education, a series of other trends that are happening that we're going to highlight in the coming slides. And so this is really a new phase that we need to consider and ask ourselves as leaders a series of questions in terms of where we make investments, where we're at today, and where we want to head in the future. Next slide, please, slide 7. Get a little external perspective on what rating agencies are saying, S&P as well as Moody's. After 4 years of negative with S&P, we're on to stable, and with negative and Moody's, we're also on to stable. So they are seeing things move in a more positive direction, largely due to substantial federal emergency funding, successful return to campus, looking at operating revenue projections. On the other hand, there are a series of risks to monitor. Enrollment pressures, as I've mentioned, are happening, as well as social cyber risks are continuing to increase. Joe Sunbury had mentioned, the risks to monitor, as well as just the pressures on operating budgets, largely due to recent inflation, but just continued cost, especially with pressures on keeping our tuition the same. Next slide, please. But there is value in higher education. I think you all truly understand the value of higher education. Next slide, please, slide 8. And you also understand the value of investing in higher education. Frankly, sometimes it's hard to quantify. The left-hand side talks about voting rolls. You know, that's one way we sometimes look at it in terms of, you know, people that are educated tend to have higher voting percentages. Of course, all of our citizens are important for voting. And we look at on the right-hand side, income is only one proxy for individuals' contributions, but that's we're seeing significant variations from a education perspective too. So, you know, these are just two charts in a kind of societal perspective on the value of education, but it really is talking about the value investing in higher education. Next slide, please, slide 9. So what's been happening is a series of other states are indicating they are going to be increasing their focus on education, increasing their investment in education. We see Texas talk about talent for strong Texas. California is increasing their investment with a series of major proposals. And of course, every state makes their own determinations as to how to allocate funds. This graph on the right talks about educational appropriations and net tuition revenue by state. We'll see where on the red arrow where Nevada is in the continuum there. And if we flip to the next slide, that divides it out between the two portions, the public higher education appropriations, next slide, as well as net tuition on the right. And we see the higher education appropriations, next slide, slide 10, please. If you all can see that on the left, Nevada is, I would say, the bottom quarter of that, as well as really close to the bottom in terms of net tuition. And what we're seeing here is just the financial funds available to invest in education. And not my place to comment on is more or less better or worse, but just making sure as regents you're seeing what's out there as compared to others. And I think, you know, in terms of the opportunities presented now as we come out of this pandemic towards the future, an opportunity to ask ourselves a series of questions. And those questions are similar to questions we could be asked today. Next slide, please, on slide 11. What trends have been occurring within higher education? I'm going to be answering a lot of that. We answered some last year. Of course, next year we can answer them again. Trends keep on changing. But I think for you to consider as regents and just for all higher education leaders in the state to consider is the second question and the third. What do we see as the future of higher education in our state? And what investments are required to realize that future? And, you know, I think we're going to see in a series of our upcoming slides, there's some opportunities to present on how we make investments, not just making investments across the board, but where we make investments with highest and best return, okay? So please just kind of think about these questions as we go forward. All right, next slide, please, slide 12. So we are going to cover a series of what I would call notable items from 2021. I'm gonna do this rather quickly because we covered this last year, and there really is set up to some subsequent items, though they are still relevant today. So next slide, please. We're going to be charting a future course, a new operating model. So as I mentioned last year and a little bit, I think this is a critical time for higher education. We're seeing the effects of the pandemic from an enrollment perspective. We're seeing it from a rising cost perspective. We're getting questions regarding values of degree. We're having increasing compliance requirements and considerations about enrollment cliff and just how do we leverage technology. There's a lot of questions about how do we deliver education in the best optimal way? How do we best serve our mission? And that creates an opportunity for us to consider our operating model, both in terms of mission delivery as well as financial performance. Next slide, please. There's, of course, a series of challenges that are out there. It's not all gloomy. There's great opportunities out there. But effectively, we do have to continue to pursue bottom line cost reduction and top line growth. Top line growth being revenue increases and cost reduction where we can without adversely affecting mission. We see this in the face of the identification of inequities across higher education, certain populations not being served to the degree by the industry as well as others. We'll talk about that more in a bit. And as we make investments to try and right the ship from an equitable perspective. The same issues that cause many potential college students to not apply affect students when they're in school and create a challenge with the need at the adult learner population. And I know from conversations we've had in the past, you all see your role to be serving the state's needs, period. And I think higher education is a way to do that. Next slide is a path to the future, slide 15. Just thinking about those three questions I asked, about where are we at today, where should we be in the future, what's our vision? And this is a unique opportunity, I think, that we all have now to think about how do we chart that course forward, both for our traditional college-age populations, our adult learners, four-year, two-year institutions collectively across the board, an opportunity to really revision the future. Slide 16 involves, this is looking at sources of revenue. Is it looking at from an existing sources, next slide please, existing sources, or is it with prior sources? Is it new markets or existing markets? Next slide 16 please. And you know, there's some opportunities to look through geographic expansion. Obviously you limited to the state there, but looking at within the state, looking at our audience that we're effectively serving, those that we're traditionally serving versus who we could serve and what products and services would best resonate with our population within the state. So slide 17 is actually just pushing the boundaries, what I like to say from a thought leadership perspective. Imagine a future with national universities. Actually, this is what's really happening. Universities are growing very, very, very large. Some having over 100,000 students from an online perspective. And you know, the size and scale of institutions is growing demonstrably. And I think this is an opportunity for us to try and figure out ways to survive and thrive within our state, within our respective catchment area. Next slide, please. We're going to shift and move forward to budgeting. Everyone's favorite topic, I'm sure. So budgeting, transformation in higher education. Why do we talk about this? Next slide, please. Slide 19. Budgeting has transformed dramatically within the time of COVID. Pre-COVID, a lot of institutions just had kind of same story, moving the budget forward year over year over year. But budgeting has really, truly transformed so dramatically in COVID. Why? Next slide, please. Slide 20. Because the whole equation of higher education has altered. Slide 20 speaks to, are we have on the left-hand side, next slide please, external demand. We have in the middle academic value generation, and the right-hand side, institutional impact and achievement. I think if we look back, not say the last 5 years, but at the prior 20 years, external demand, academic value generation, institutional impact and achievement, all these things were largely stable. But what's happened in the last few years is all three of these elements have changed. Perspectives have changed in terms of demand. What am I demanding? When am I demanding it? Am I wanting online and in person? Who within our population, traditional college age or older populations, considering it? Academic value generation, who is considering how do we make investments? How do we transform that demand into outcomes? And what metrics are we looking at? All of this is really being revisioned in the past few years, which just happens to coincide with the time of COVID. So budgeting, how we allocate our resources, how do we allocate our resources toward the mission is also, of course, having to change. Slide 21. So this brings up additional tools to use for that. One is cost of education modeling. Cost of education modeling, next slide, please. What is it? It's determining, helping us determine not just on a direct basis, but also on an indirect, fully costed basis. What does it cost to graduate an English major? What does it cost to graduate a physics major? Are they different? Why are they different? They are different, let me tell you. But to do so, you have to pull all the costs together and the revenues determine the margin. Some have higher margin than others. That's not a bad or a good thing. In reality, it's part of our portfolio approach. Every, dare I say, business takes that approach. And you know, we in higher education have to also do so. Next slide, please. We use activity-based costing to try and do that across the industry. Many institutions are doing so. And why are they doing so? Slide 24, next slide, please. Basically, to try and look at the idea of the inherent implication of increasing costs inherently leads to increased quality outcomes. Next slide, slide 24, please. And in reality, we have to break this traditional mindset of just increasing investment increases increased outputs. In the reality, there's not necessarily a linear equation. And when we have to look at increasing investments, sometimes that happens. Other times we have to look at how we make investments towards efficiency and effectiveness. And the cost of education modeling, determining what the true cost of graduating these majors would be, understanding our true costs in a very analytical way, enables us to truly make some investments as an institution towards our mission the best we can with the funds that are available. Next slide, please. Actually, skipping to slide 25, please. Moving on to tailoring fundraising to generational nuances. Fundraising has changed. Next slide, please. Fundraising has changed due to a variety of factors over the past 5 years. Technology has changed. New channels happen. Looking at recent information and understanding, you know, who's on Facebook, who's not on Facebook as an example. But, you know, the digital technology channels are extraordinary in terms of how they're proliferating and ways to get eyeballs on requests for fundraising. And what we're seeing is beyond the technology, next slide, please, slide 27, is how this varies across generations. We can't just have one message, one channel, one action or activity, next slide, please, slide 27, to be able to illustrate our value to the market. To ask for funds happens in different ways. We're seeing the four generations across the top. You know, we're seeing left-hand generation look for offline channels, getting, you know, checks in to requests in the mail, whereas on the right, Gen Z looking live, online, using a more digital approach. We see millennials where cause matters, not just what is the ask, but why am I being asked? How does this generate the value? And Gen Z wants to organize that within their strong desire to do a social good, and you know they want to see the outcome. Whereas the boomers, the left-hand generation, looking for more of a more sizable gift towards capital campaigns, a more traditional way of giving. The point is, the ways to ask for money to the market, which is a revenue to support this margin needs and investment, we really need to think about different ways to engage depending on the channel, depending on the population we're targeting, et cetera. And of course, these generations move to the right in terms of as they become more and more ability to give and generate value for our revenues. Next slide, please. I'm going to round out some of the key items for 2021 and shift into 2022. Supporting students in mental health. This is maybe sounds like a bit of a softer item, but it is a very important item. Slide 29. Mental health challenges persist, although we identified this in 2021. They continue into 2022. Anxiety and depression continue to be the most common presented concerns assessed by clinicians in 2020. And actually, the numbers just continue to increase. Approximately 60% of students seeking services reporting prior mental health treatment versus 48% in 12 and 13. And, you know, traditionally, we as institutions across the industry have underinvested in this area, becoming a critical factor not only to take care of our populations, but also it's really critical from the bottom bullet, retention and graduation rates improve when students are healthier, have better mental capacity. And so looking at ways to just continue to invest across the board, there's a lot of areas, and this is but one of them for us to consider. Some examples on slide 30 of how other institutions are doing this within the public arena. Okay, I will take a breath, slide 31, next slide. So we have three sections for 2022. I'm going quickly as promised, and we're gonna talk about creating an equitable and sustainable growth, equitable and sustainable future, which I think means growth, and a few different articles, ideas that we are raising within there, both in terms of educational equity and also raising the idea of ESG. So next slide, we're going to talk about a framework for educational equity. If you can go to next slide, please, slide 33. So traditionally speaking in higher ed, we use the term access. Access is not equity. Just giving somebody access to education doesn't necessarily result in positive outcomes. People can go to an institution that they may not complete. They can complete, but maybe not in the same way as somebody else. So access is very different than equity. Access was, I think, the term that we as an industry traditionally have used. Now we look for equitable outcomes. And actually, Grant Thornton created a framework for educational equity, which we're sharing here with you, with the industry, that we'll go through in terms of how there are various places of inequity within the higher education landscape, not isolating higher education in particular, just this is the area where we care about. We want to make sure that there's equitable outcomes. And frankly, enhancing equity not only serves our states, our constituents, our economies, our societies, and our students, it also frankly makes quote unquote good business sense, given the enrollment challenges we mentioned, to try and grow the ability to educate and move towards completion. Next slide, please. This slide may have some builds on it, so I'll go through. So this the framework is going to build on the left, and I'll just go through one at a time. So total market starts the largest. This is our educational equity framework. Total market includes all individuals who are eligible for post-secondary education. Do the next click, please, and the slide will build. The total addressable market is within there to say those who actually apply post-secondary education. There's many reasons why someone might not apply. They may not believe in themselves. They might not feel like they have the experience. They just don't have the chance. They're going to wait a few years. The point is a smaller population. Then we move into the next click, the serviceable available market, the SAM. Those include the individuals who are accepted and enroll into post-secondary institutions. Even if you apply, you might not have put together a great application. You not, might not have the right experience. You might not be accepted by the institution or actually decide I can do this and move towards enrollment. We already are identifying several different layers of inequity, and we could spend time on that. The next one is the serviceable obtainable market, the SOM. The includes the individuals who persist and complete their credentials. So not only have they been accepted and enroll, but they actually persist and complete their credentials. But just because you complete your credentials doesn't mean you could do so equitably. So the next click is a serviceable equitable market, the SEM, those individuals who equitably complete their credentials, paving the way for equitable future. So I'll just start at the highest level. Who's in the total market of potential? Who could join our post-secondary institutions? Who actually decides to apply? Series of inequities there. Series of inequities as to who actually is accepted, and who actually determines that they can enroll. Those that actually continue through and persist versus get off the train, and those that complete, but just because you complete doesn't mean you can complete the same way. A Black Latinx student versus a white student, it has been shown to have different results, both in terms of degree choices as well as different performance, depending on social structures and support. That's just looking at race, not only kind of socioeconomic factors, not looking at gender. And then of course, post-graduation, we're seeing very different outcomes in post-graduation salary when you look at gender, race, et cetera, et cetera. So the question is, I think, for you all to consider as we go to this section, this framework for educational equity, where are we as regions focused? Where are we, or are institutions focused? Where have we invested traditionally? Where have we not invested traditionally? And I think traditionally speaking on that prior framework, if you can go back one click, we as an industry have invested in what we call the SAM, which is the maroon, which is financial aid, enabling someone to enroll. Okay, you got here, you're here. But now I think we need to think through, well, are we providing ourselves available and access to enough students? Or what types of students are we letting in? And then once they're here, how do we make sure that they are complete and do so equitably? So the next slide is just a series of questions, which I'll blaze over now, but basically, some questions for you all to consider in terms of, and your institutions to consider to say, are we equitably serving our markets? Are our markets growing or shrinking? Who are the students we're serving now? Who are the students we should be serving? And, you know, the quote at the bottom, I think, is you probably all agree with this. While attending college is not essential for all, it's not, providing the opportunity for everyone to realize their potential is. So what we want to do is give the opportunity to anyone that can be educated and go to college. And the question is, what barriers are in place? Something to consider, I think, given your stature and in your positions. Next slide is a series of other questions to consider. And I would say, you know, looking across the board, not speaking about Nevada in general, we definitely see just the drop off from high school to college. And then, of course, the significant drop off of those who come in and don't end up graduating. And this is a rare industry that has that much of a drop off from high school to college. And then of our customers, dare I use that term, within the population, not actually getting to a point of completion. Okay, so that's, I think, the next slide, please, kind of something for you to consider from a growth perspective. It's not just how do we grow, do we grow, how do we generate appropriate financials, but how do we grow in an equitable way? The next two articles or items here are about ESG, which for those of you that are familiar, environmental, social, and governance. I'll cover this. I think this is probably familiar to most at this point. I'll blaze through a couple of these things. Slide 38, next slide, please. ESG, many institutions, many nonprofits, many corporate entities are embracing ESG, trying to look for ways to really assess their own commitments to ESG, double down on those. Many campuses have shifted towards a net zero approach. They're looking for innovative sources of funding. They're filtering that in terms of where the funding sources are coming in. They're divesting of fossil fuels. You know, I know this relates to Nevada in terms of your commitment to environmentalism. And of course, this resonates not just with our desires as institutions, but also with the importance to our students and our constituents. Next slide, please. This is just a few examples of some higher education institutions that are making commitments to ESG, both the E, the S, and the G, which is a critical component of ongoing strategies in this space. Okay, that was a quick one. Slide 40. This is a bit of an extension on that. Thinking about ESG is not just kind of based on what we can and should be doing, but it, frankly, there's a compliance element too that's seeking its way in. So that's in slide 41. Thinking about different ways of looking at DE&I and ESG from a compliance lens, this is becoming more and more the case of answering from a external perspective. And so, you know, it's a little hard to always determine where we require as this field evolves. So our recommendation, as you focus on this as a leadership team, slide 42, next slide, three circles, is go ahead and take a three-step process to collect and reporting on DE&I and ESG metrics at the board level, executive team, the regions level, at the institutions level, monitor the policies, goals, and requirements, and understand the needs to report and look at a way of continuous improvement. This is, we're seeing to be really, really critical in terms of resonating with our internal constituents, our students, et cetera, as well as external constituents at the state level, as well as the public. Okay. All right. Next slide for, thank you. Navigating the great reshuffle. I would say this section's a little bit softer, but it's important. It's about our people. It's about who we have within our institutions. There's been a material drop in employment within higher education, just like in general across many industries within the pandemic. There's a slide on that later. The great reshuffle, sometimes called the great resignation, or just in general, the fight to retain our talent. We're seeing just massive amount of changing of employees from one role to another, one institution to another, and salaries go up, and you know this is becoming challenged, in, especially with state institutions, as salaries can be fixed, and they're seeing in the open market how they can get their salaries increased by 5, 10, 15, et cetera. But it's critical for mission success, and I'll go through these three articles and get to a bit of more of a harder section on strengthening the campus in just a couple of minutes. So next slide talks about the workforce strategies for the new age. Next slide, please. A stat from earlier this year was 40% of the global workforce is considering leaving their current employer. That was earlier this year. That may have shifted now, but we're seeing still some challenges in recent publications that we've actually done is the challenges that faculty are feeling across the industry in terms of whether they themselves are heard. So this results in issues for both faculty and staff. Of course, this relates to competitive advantage of higher education being mission focused, which relates very much to ESG. So there's a nice kind of dovetails that prior section. Slide 46 here is workforce strategies for the new age. This is a way to think about things turning on their head. Really, there's two things, if I could summarize this slide in a flash. One, flexibility. It's not, you know, 9 to 5 in the chair every day kind of job as it always has been. Many institutions are accepting this. Many are actually turning towards accepting high-level executives, C-level executives that are not even based in the state are basically remote almost all the time. And then thinking about our mission focus and the mission focus in terms of how it provides value, especially from an ESG perspective, as it's becoming critical to many people as a differentiator in terms of making sure that we are servicing their needs. So sharing your mission, embracing the flexibility, grounding your organization in those perspectives. Next slide, please. We're going to talk about strategy of hiring and retaining talent, which frankly is a little bit more of the same. Next slide, 48. Go through this section quickly. So hiring and retaining talent. In this section, I would say in general is more for management than the regions, but still important to make sure this is out there and on the record. It's really taking, I would call, a customer lens towards our employees, understanding what they want and what they aren't getting today. In fact, many institutions are taking a look at what benefits, what compensation benefits they provide to their employees and understanding actually the packages that we're buying today are not actually aligned with their priorities. Not always possible in the public space, but they're looking at ways of reducing certain areas of their benefits because they weren't as important to their employees. They thought they were, but they weren't, and increasing other areas that are actually more important than were considered. So kind of reallocating the portfolio for more positive effects. Slide 49, not to be underestimated, just listening to intently to employees and taking a personalized approach. The criticality here is just how do we manage, how do we work, illustrating the issuance of surveys, finding out how things are going. Again, we just recently issued a survey and realized there are a number of faculty in particular that do not feel that they're not, of course, in Nevada, just across the board, but that do not feel heard, do feel their voices are heard. And that becomes a critical, let's call it compensation factor in and of itself to make sure they're part of the mission achievement, they're listened to by leadership. Some questions, slide 50, that they would consider are here. Those are all things that are considered. Last little bit there, if you go forwards, next slide, before actually, leadership strategies in a virtual world. So again, this is more for management than for the regions, but just thinking about ways to collaborate with our employees, to listen to our employees. The old world of kind of command and control, and they will do what I say all the time, isn't the case in an employee-driven workforce. So thinking about ways that we really support our teams, set clear expectations, let them rise to the occasion. Again, this may seem soft, but in the reality, we're going through a major shift, and we have to shift like this to retain our talent, especially in places where our compensation may be fixed, to think about different ways of managing and supporting their own growth. That's summarized on page 53, leadership strategies in a virtual world. Okay, I'm going to take a breath here. We're going to move to slide 54, which is our last section. Again, this is the last section in our 2022, strengthening the campus. And I would say we're going from a little softer to harder, meaning we're going to get into the operations a bit in terms of what's been happening. So as we come out of the pandemic, I think we're seeing in general, not just in higher education, but many, many nonprofits, commercial entities, et cetera, are seeing we had a bit of, if I can say, dare say, deferred maintenance. Not deferred maintenance on our buildings, if that was the case too, but deferred maintenance on our systems, on our people, on our process, et cetera. And there's become a significant investment in just moving in that direction. So this section kind of touches on some of that. So slide 55, next slide. We're going to start with student preferences help drive the change. So if I can go to next slide, 56. So this is, again, taking that customer-centric lens to say what is actually important to our constituents, both constituents in the state that are not currently served and those students that are currently served by the institutions. Remember that framework on DE&I, the idea of like, how do we make investments towards success once somebody is actually in the chair? How do we get them to a point of graduation in an equitable way so they can be graduating on par with their peers? That's an idea of student preference towards driving change. What's important to me as a quote unquote customer, dare I use that term, and thinking about benefiting not just themselves educationally, but also their whole self, which is a critical idea within for students today. What's slide 57 talks about what attracts students is changing. So always important to stay in touch with our constituents in terms of what's important to them. Many are looking for specialized licensing programs and R&D options, opportunities for corporate internships. The prior slide had mentioned micro-credentialing. There's all kinds of things that are changing in terms of the things that folks are looking for, not just the traditional degree, not just the traditional academic prestige or my family went here, et cetera, et cetera. So preferences are changing, which drives how we make investments in our facilities, et cetera. Next slide hits on M&A. M&A shifting gears quite considerably, is accelerating in higher education. Now, I would say other industries are having more M&A, had more M&A during COVID. At the end of the day, we are seeing more than we have seen. 2017 to 21, there were, I think, 51 closings or mergers, which is significantly up in the prior 5 period. And it's projected to continue increasing. What's been happening, economic challenges have created significant issues. We've seen that in the state of Nevada. We're seeing it in other state institutions pick up private institutions that need a lifeline to be able to fold it into the public institution. If I can go to the next slide, we're seeing, you know, I think this cements my point. We're seeing declining enrollment, especially for those institutions that are off on their own places, need a lifeline to be connected to a system. They're having higher operating costs, the margins are shrinking, and increasing competition. I'm describing before how some institutions have, you know, well over 100,000 students, especially the online. It creates an issue of if you're off in the middle of the state, trying to get enough people in the chairs when in reality they can just as easily go online. That creates a problem in terms of keeping those locations open. Next slide, you know, underscores the pandemic is really spurring this activity. Again, this is the idea of the trend was happening for many, many years, but frankly, the pandemic accelerated, exacerbated that trend. But I would say in one way, because of all the federal funding that came in, it actually allowed many institutions to stay afloat that wouldn't have otherwise. So I predict, and I think we're seeing many others predict in the next 5 years, this continues to accelerate because those lifelines have gone away. Strengthening the campus, next slide, 61, rethinking facilities and workforce expenses. If you go to next slide, 62, the reason why we highlighted facilities and workforce, huge areas of expenditure for institutions and just going up. Right, we're seeing massive inflation this year. You know, the price of milk is up 10%, and eggs and chicken, and the facilities maintenance is there, and workforce salaries is the same. And you know, as we see a need for investment of resources, as I mentioned before, to generate higher levels of quality, higher levels of outcome, supporting special student populations from a DE&I perspective and an equality perspective, we can't always get that from higher revenues. Some places we can. Other times we have to look at ways we're deploying our costs. And these costs are increasing, putting further squeezing on the margin. So 63, next slide, causes us to rethink our facilities and workforce expenses. Keyword is flexibility. What spaces do we have today? Do we need all those spaces? Are we getting maximum use out of all those spaces? If the facility is only used for courses between 10 and 2 p.m. on Tuesdays and Thursdays, that building is not being fully used. How else can we or others utilize that space? Single-use classrooms should be supporting a hybrid model, thinking about working with our communities, just bringing, blowing apart the walls and trying to ingratiate more utilization of the spaces. Hoteling for people, especially if they're not required to be on site 100%. We're seeing this come in, which has been in the for-profit realm for years, is coming into the higher education space quite demonstrably in terms of utilizing giving the workforce the chance to be working in the way that they want to work, but also with the facilities perspective, trying to give them a chance to reduce our footprint or redeploy the resources towards academics or other purposes. Slide 64 is just interesting. And from a graph, we threw that in there here, seeing just the crash of workers that are employed by higher education. And you see what's happened. It's grown. Until the pandemic happened and it fell demonstrably. This happened across a lot of industries. And the question is, we build back up. The question is, do we build back up in the same way, with the same lines, with the same deployment? Is just adding resources in the same way going to generate quality or effect? In reality, it may be highest best use, thinking about that towards populations in need, towards growth, towards retention, et cetera. Okay, next slide, almost there, 65. Supporting mission through technology. I'll just kind of say at deferred maintenance all over the place here across the industry. We never have really excelled with a technology perspective. And now we have really, many institutions are significantly behind and the students are expecting higher performance in technology and the employees are as well. And so the next slide, please, slide 66. Many institutions are looking at back office automation, investing in their enterprise resource management, enterprise resource planning, ERP tools. They're investing in their development in CRM tools. They're investing in all kinds of different back office programs in order to really level up with where they should have been as institutions, which not only helps from a controls perspective, but also efficiency and effectiveness. We're looking at institutions create an integrated vision for their technology across the enterprise, making investments there. Slide 67 just hits on the point of planning. And I would end with the last little item here, slide 66, which is a case for a customer-centric approach. And I know I've mentioned this a couple times, but I've mentioned it because this word is sometimes regarded as, dare I say, a dirty word, customers in the higher education space. I like to say we do have customers. We have the state. We have our students. We have everything in between, the society, the economy, et cetera. They're all really customers. And if we take that customer mindset, next slide, please, 69, we understand who our customers are, what they want, how to serve them. And if we're as regents, as leaders, I say this to the industry as well, just how do we make investments towards what's important to our customers, what makes a difference to our mission, we have to understand what they want will resonate, okay? So I'm going to hit a wrap-up section here, slide 70, just moving towards the road ahead. I think I'm going to leave you with one slide and then some Q&A if you're interested. Slide 71, next slide, which is the state of higher education in 2022, the road ahead. I can't believe I made 76 slides in 45 minutes. We did it. So, okay, a new record. So investing in infrastructure on the left, investing in growth on the right. This is what's really happening in 2022. What do the prior 70 slides mean? It means we have to invest in our infrastructure to level up how we function from an efficiency perspective, an effectiveness perspective, controls perspective. And we have to think about ways for growth. Being of the same size and scale as we've always been, especially given that we're underpenetrated into our high school graduating senior population, is not where we should be. Especially as we're not fully penetrated into the adult learner population. We can grow. Even though the pandemic was hard, even though it put pressures on us and it was scary at times, this is the interesting thing about 2022 versus 2021. There is a sense of potential for growth. What are they investing in on the left-hand side? They're investing in ERM, enterprise risk management. They're investing in reserves planning, future readiness, just in general, cost containment, business continuity planning, investing in IT systems, cost of education modeling, all these tools that basically say, let us up our game, let us operate if from an efficiency and effectiveness perspective to better serve our mission, better serve employees, stretch our current employee base across what they need to do in a better way, investing in growth. Looking at our mission, are we really truly optimally serving our mission? Are we serving our state in the way that we can? Are we serving our students in the way that we can? What is our strat plan? What is the action plan towards that strat plan? And as a higher education landscape changes, are we appropriately positioned within the landscape? Are we just doing the things that we've always done in the way that we've always done them? Should we be doing them differently? Can we take a customer mindset, a product mindset? And thinking about financial and operational modeling, just thinking about ways to better deploy our resources towards a mission. Last one is M&A and JV and transactions. I know that that's happened to a degree within the state. To what extent are there more opportunities to really build ourselves and better serve our mission, better serve the state, better serve the constituents? So I will pause there. Again, I hope you found this to be useful. Maybe you found one section, one slide to be more useful than the others. Maybe you found the whole thing to be interesting. But I would just reinforce the three questions I asked at the beginning. What are the trends? I think we covered that. And thinking about what is the future looking like and where is you as leaders care to make investments towards an improved mission achievement.
Thank you. Do we have questions or comments?
Question.
Is that Regent Arascata?
It is. Thank you, Regent Carter. For the gentleman who just did one heck of a presentation, on page 71, the last item that you just reflected on was the investments in infrastructure and the investment in growth. I look at these two items and then I reflect back upon page number 60, where you give significant data about the average cost of a four-year institute has gone up 497% since 85 to 2018. Fortune 500 companies have decreased or ceased, to exist over the past decade. For academic and academia will most likely follow the same paradigm. And the last one in just a two-year period between November 19 and November 21, undergraduate enrollment has declined 7.8%. With those three declines in downtrodden direction, how do you propose we go ahead and focus on the investment in infrastructure and the investment in growth?
For the record, Matt Unterman with Grant Thornton. Thank you for your question. I'll attempt to answer here. If you want to have a back and forth, I'm more than happy to do so. I would give, first of all, wonderful interpolation of the data, and I think you asked a really fine question there. And frankly, you summarized the overarching challenge. How do we make investments when our costs are going up, when our potentially volume is going down, and the expectations just keep on going up, up, up? It is a hard business model to figure out how to optimize. So I'll just kind of grant you that. I have a couple items that I think of. So first of all, the undergraduate enrollment may have declined. It declined inconsistently across four-year and two-year institutions. It's declined inconsistently across the U.S. And you see the enrollment cliff coming up. It's up, declining inconsistently from a geographic perspective. So some states are going to be less impacted than others. That said, I think one solution out of this is volume, meaning who are we serving? Out of those that are graduating high school, are we serving enough of them within our higher education institutions as a state? That's for you to answer, not for me. We are not serving them all, that's for sure. For those individuals that are within our higher education institutions, are we graduating enough of them within 4 years, within 6 years? Are we serving them in the right way? Again, for you to answer, not for me, but I think that's another volume thing, making sure that we retain our current customers towards mission. And then, of course, not everyone goes to college right away. There's educational needs in the state beyond the 18 to 22 to 24-year-olds. And are we adequately servicing that need? Again, these are all questions from a strategy perspective. The mathematical equation is, you know, price times volume minus expenses equals margin. So volume is one way to do it. The other way to consider is, and you're referring to slide numbers, and frankly, I'm a bit sheepish being this direct, but I think it's worth considering, right, is up front, we had some stats on the state distribution, slide 9 and slide 10. And I think we look at, you know, where Nevada is compared to other states, and we have to ask ourselves, is that appropriate? And again, I don't have the answer, but, you know, in terms, pardon the pun, but in terms of appropriations, is that the right level? As well as net tuition, is that also at the right level? And I think those are questions that need to be answered to think about ways that we can affect change within our state and whether we can achieve our mission. So I don't know if that completely answered your question. I'm happy to have some more dialogue back and forth in case it didn't.
It did. But my question is, yes, thank you. Sorry, Regent Carter. But Mr. Unterman, at the very end, you just stated about our structure in regards to tuition. Are you making the encouragement to increase or decrease the tuition in order to follow the lead of what other states and the success in which they're finding or seeing, I should say?
Yeah, for the record, Matt Unterman with Grant Thornton, It's a great question. I'm not sure I have the insight and analysis, frankly, to provide clear guidance to you in terms of all the balance you would say. I would say net tuition, which is what that slide indicates, is actually full tuition minus financial aid. So there's a way that theoretically some states are able to increase their base tuition, but then provide more financial aid, potentially keeping net tuition the same or increasing that tuition if their discounting is just held commensurate. So that's a trend that's happened in other states. There's other states that have employed not a base tuition increase, but have done differential tuition, depending on the degree, a graduate or undergraduate or various degrees. they would look at ways to do differential tuition as a way to increase net tuition total while keeping base tuition the same. So there's a lot of different creative ways to go about it. Understanding that folks from a pocketbook perspective can only understand so much. So I think that would have to be a study in terms of your own state, people's ability to pay and willingness to pay. I know I'm not really not answering your question, but I would say you're asking the right question, which is what should we do? And I think that's a study to consider.
Thank you, Mr. Enderman. Thank you, Regent Carter.
Were there any other questions or discussion? Not sure if we have any more or not. While we're waiting for a couple seconds, I'll just say there's so many stories to be told by these numbers, and that was one of them that I was going to bring up, is, you know, our tuition that we charge the students is relatively low compared to a lot of states. So there is some affordability there. But at the same time, our state contributes on the lower end of the amount of money versus a lot of states. There's a great slide on just the income distributions or the median incomes for people that have different levels of education. So you could take any one of these slides and tell a story and communicate the importance of higher education and things that we should be doing. Were there any other questions or discussion? Hearing none and seeing none, thank you so much.
Chair Carter?
Yes.
I had a thought when you were talking about tuition being lower than most places, although in the ARSA committee this morning, we saw the slide, even with our grants and our scholarships and our lower tuition, the slide we saw showed our students still in debt. And I realized it costs money to educate. But I think that's just another layer of that story that you were talking about, that we need to look at the whole big picture. There's not like just one simple thing that we can do. It's going to take a great deal of thought and planning and being very strategic about solving this with all the changes I saw in the slide. I loved the presentation. And I couldn't wait to hear you present it because I kept trying to figure it out on my own prior to the meeting. But I really appreciate what you shared with us today. Thank you.
Matt Unterman, for the record, with Grant Thornton. Thank you very much, Regent McAdoo. And I think, obviously, those couple of slides up front require some focused attention. And I didn't do a lot of focused attention for this. We moved over a lot of material. But I do think your point is appropriate. There's a price point, and even at that price point, there's debt that's incurred. And the reality is those slides about the economic support that's provided at the state is a strategic slide. And I think what I would say is all of that should be intentional from your perspective and the state's perspective. Not saying it's not, but I think the reality is something to consider in terms of, are we at the right levels to properly support institutions and their service to the mission. Costs are going up in reality. So thank you very much, Chair Carter and Joe Sunbury and the entire Regents for the opportunity to speak and to support you and look forward to future conversations as appropriate. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Enterman. We'll move on to item number 9, new business. Do we have any new business? Hearing none and seeing none, we'll move on to item number 210, public comment. Doesn't look like we have any public comment in Vegas. Is there any in Reno?
There is none in Reno.
And is there any in Elko?
No, there's none in Elko.
So this meeting is adjourned.